But I think we're joined by John Philpott. Are you there, John?
Yes, I'm there. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much for being our guest. We want to ask you about this. You participated as a juror in a type of trial, and I want you to explain all that, if you would. And by the way, there is a site, criminalizewar.org. Did I get that right?
Yes, and it's with an S.
S, yeah.
Criminalize.
Yes. Somebody once argued that it's now time to get rid of the Z, because people have a lot of trouble on looking things up. They run into it. So maybe we should ban it. So criminalizewar.org. So this took place in Kuala Lumpur. Is that right?
Yes, yes. This tribunal, the Kuala Lumpur War Crimes Tribunal, has been in existence since 2009, and its main idea is to criminalize war following on the Nuremberg experience, where crimes against peace, waging aggressive war, is the cause of most war crimes, and most war crimes flow from it. It came, of course, in the context of the American-British aggression on Iraq as an important factor in forming this tribunal, because they had two judgments. They sat before I was on the court. I was named to the court as a judge in about a month ago. Mm-hmm. But they sat on and found George Bush and Tony Blair guilty of war crimes in the war on Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
This time it was charges against Israel for its policy of genocide since 1947, and against a general named Amos Yaron, who was the man in charge on the spot in the Sabra Shatila massacres in September 1982. Many of us remember that, and some of your listeners don't, of course.
Mm-hmm.
Now,
it certainly was a shocking episode, and it hasn't been forgotten. I mean, it does reappear in the media periodically, and there have been inquiries at various places, right? But this one, when this body met, did they take into account other investigations and other findings?
Yes, because by the nature of our hearing, we heard evidence. We incorporated evidence heard elsewhere. And in Israel, they had a fairly complete investigation, although the findings were somewhat skewed. And because in Israel, there's a lot of opposition to that war. There was 400,000 people demonstrated. So there was the Kahan Commission in Israel, and there's Sean McBride's commission, and several books which have been written, which brought out the basic facts, many of the basic facts, which then were supplemented by our witnesses who were present during the war on Sabra and Shatila.
Mm-hmm.
The basic, to put it in a nutshell, Israel encircled the area. They invaded and occupied Lebanon on a flash after the murder of Mr. Gemayel on the 14th. I could be wrong on the date.
Mm-hmm.
And they came in there and they encircled it, shut off all exits, and sent in the Falange and the SLA, which is Lebanese Christian militia, into the camps.
Mm-hmm.
And they made the defense we didn't really know. And the key evidence was that they could see everything. They controlled everything. They had coordinators in their supervisory positions overlooking the Sabra and Shatila camps.
Mm-hmm.
They gave bulldozers to the Falangists to clean up, and they were really in control.
Mm-hmm.
And modern international criminal law has and criminal law in general has developed the idea that you can be responsible for a crime even if you don't pull the trigger.
Well, indeed. And I mean, yes, that's. That's the kind of thing that always comes to mind. I have to ask you, based on my memory, there was it was reported at the time that their lights had been turned on, powerful lights, in order to sort of enable people who were carrying out murders in the camp.
Yes, well, there was evidence of that, of a lot of lights, and evidence of being able to see exactly what was going on. The tribunal, because we sat as a tribunal, and we used legal principles, was convinced beyond all reasonable doubt that Amos Yaron was responsible for the elimination of somewhere between 800 and 3,500 Palestinians, men, actually, in this case, mostly women and children and elderly men, because the fighters had all left a month earlier. And it was really an attempt to exterminate people in that camp, because they knew very well there were no arms. When the phalangists went in there, a couple of people had guns and shot back, but there was no organized fight resistance.
Yeah. Well, by the way, I mean, that's a name and word we haven't heard, which is very important to understand what happened in Lebanon. That is phalange. There were elements in Lebanon, you describe them as Christian elements, actually a sect or sectarian group within the Christian community.
Yes, of course.
Who were bent on guaranteeing success for Israel. I mean, they were collaborating with Israel,
sure.
no question. I believe, actually, when Israel withdrew, many of them went with Israel back into Israeli territory.
Well, there's another group called the SLA, which I think in Arab is called Kataib. Excuse me for your Arab listeners who will misunderstand my terms, but the SLA, which is the South Lebanese Army, was really a part of the Israeli army. They had Israeli uniforms, and they were paid by Israelis, and they had food from the Israeli army.
My gosh, so you know, as an historical incident, that was an amazing moment in modern history. As you say, of course, now it's quite long past, but it continues to resonate, because my memory is that the Israeli army reached the gates of Beirut. They basically had Beirut under siege. And if I'm not mistaken, there was an embarrassing episode where Jane Fonda and her husband showed up in support of Israel on that, to his great shame. He's issued statements now. This is a former American congressman and her ex-husband. But it was quite a moment. People thought they were going to knock out the PLO at that time. But they didn't succeed.
That was a few months earlier. To make
prior to the killings, yes.
They went in Israel I think in June, the date I don't have it clearly. They fought, they didn't win, it was a standoff, and then they negotiated the exit of the PLO fighters, and they left in mid-August, around a month before this all happened.
A seminal episode in Middle Eastern history. John, how many judges were there, and where'd they come from?
There were seven judges. I was the only judge from outside the country. They are eminent. They're eminent jurists, experienced people in different types of law, and extremely sophisticated people. How can I characterize them? They were professors. There were former judges or judges. Some have been sat in international courts. And they reflected very carefully about the issues. And obviously, I can't talk about what the judges deliberated on, except that it was a live debate, and we didn't have our minds made up in advance.
There was a defense. Amicus curiae.
Yes. I'd like to point out also...
Was everyone, by the way, in the courtroom? Because now we're in this situation where now we have these courts where people appear through Skype and whatnot.
Yes, we did have some from Skype. We had a professor from England, in fact, an Israeli professor from England, Mr. Pape, or P-A-P-P-E, who talked about the Plan Dalet and the Israeli policy from 1947. They had an expert on reproductive issues, and showed that the war on Gaza had caused very serious reproductive problems. We had other people who'd come from the West Bank, who'd come from Gaza, and who'd come from Savarin Shatila. I think there's something, which, you know, I thought I knew everything, but I didn't know very much, in fact. After I heard all this evidence, mm-hmm. I learned a lot about this. And one of the striking things, which you may have seen, and some of your readers may know, your listeners may know this, they showed maps of Palestine and how the Israel encroaches on the Palestinian lands from 1947 till now, and the encirclement and the total strangling of the mm-hmm. Palestinians. We know about it. We hear about colonization. When you see the maps, when you yes. see videos of the roadblocks, when you see what happened in Gaza, when you hear witnesses talking about what happened in Gaza in 2008, 2009, when you hear witnesses talking about roadblocks all the time, when you hear doctors talking about the two intifadas, you realize that everybody in Palestine has been tear gassed, arrested. Not everybody's been arrested, but almost everybody has had some kind of family, close family member arrested. People are killed, physical destruction, illegal warfare, and use of phosphorus bombs in Gaza. Apparently, Gaza is not viable. It won't be viable for more than another 5 or 6 years. Mm-hmm. There's also the water.
Certainly, if things remain unchanged, and now yes. the Egyptians have closed yes. off all commerce and the mm-hmm. tunnels, etc. It has to be a deteriorating situation.
Yes. And the West Bank, the water problem, they explained where almost all the water goes to Israel, and the water to the West Bank communities is more expensive. It's really a strangulation. And I guess before 1947, there was a colonization policy, which we know about, Balfour Declaration. I think it started in 1890. And the Balfour Declaration declared it mm-hmm. as a home for, and there was a conscious policy to colonize, and then it was obviously blown out of proportion in 1947. And every country in the world, touch wood, with a couple of exceptions, like Martinique, has been become independent. But this mm-hmm. colony is still continuing. Mm-hmm. It's the extreme form of colonization and elimination of the population. And that's why we use the term genocide, which should not be used
recklessly,
too easily. It should not yeah. should not be abused, the term. But this policy towards the Palestinian people.
Now,
I think
when you say that, you're referring to Israel proper, the Gaza Strip, and the occupied West Bank.
Well, I'm referring to all the Palestinian mm-hmm. people, because mm-hmm. they're very resilient.
And those, of course, who are refugees.
Yes, yes. And so it was very striking. The other interesting issue about this court was ascribing a genocidal policy to Israel, to the state of Israel, in and of itself. And this is a novel issue in international law. There is case law which allowed for this finding. And what's interesting about it, and what may have consequences in the future, is that rather than going after only one leader, you go after a state. It may lead to ways to get reparations if this is adopted in broader international criminal law. If it becomes a principle of international law, mm-hmm. it could be a positive step. And obviously, state policy is in some ways more important than individual responsibility, which you find someone guilty and the state carries on doing the same thing. So
yeah.
this is
well,
some of the thinking.
Now,
that
yeah, which leads to a question, would the findings of this body, do you send that to the United Nations Security
yes,
Council? Do you say we've had this, this is our work and we want to examine it, and if it holds up, you should do something? Is there that kind of state position?
We called on the commission, which is the Kuala Lumpur War Crimes Commission, which runs the court to disseminate this and to go to parliaments and legislative assemblies to raise these issues, because it was a fair trial and the issues mm-hmm. are important. They're very, very immediate problems. And we look at international law and we see all these courts judging and picking at someone in Africa. and yet Israel is in flagrant violation of every United Nations resolution since 19 whatever date.
There's also several powers. France and the United States would come to mind for their work in Libya would also be serious violation, right?
Yes, of course, of course. So it was a very interesting procedure. I learned a lot. And another thing you might, how can I say it? Living in Canada, we sometimes, if we tend to have a sympathy towards Palestinians and some kind of mistrust of Israel, we're kind of like on the out. But in that part of the world, people seem to have a vision of the unfairness or the wrongness of what Israel has been doing and the perception of the Western view, colonialist view. And I felt very at ease being there and listening to the evidence and rendering a judgment because we were not, how can I say, we were, I was still circumspect about some of the charges because obviously, you know, if you sit as a judge, you have to look at it. But the evidence was convincing, and a large part of the evidence was evidence which was already brought into different commissions. And we had new evidence. A doctor who'd been through these camps, Dr. Ang, a Chinese doctor from Singapore, who had supported Israel until 1982 and had gone there on a kind of humanitarian basis and became an ardent supporter of the Palestinian refugees.
As a result of being a witness to...
being there.
Yeah, to actually, yes, to doing some investigating. This is John Philpott, a lawyer in Montreal. He was part of what's the formal title of the commission? Of the
Kuala Lumpur War Crimes Tribunal. And if anyone wants to look it up, you don't remember criminalized war. Write Kuala Lumpur War Crimes Tribunal, and then the evidence is there. The judgment is worth reading.
And you mentioned Ian Papp, for example. Can someone find his evidence, or is it just in the judgment?
It's referred to in the judgment, and I'm not sure it's on the site. But
because he's a very important author, I know that his name comes up a lot whenever he writes or says anything. There are many people who keep track of
his literature. I have a book of his, and it's very well done. It's a documentation of the of the early period in late 40s.
Well, we really appreciate it. It sounds like important work, and I assume that it was covered by the Malaysia media and media of the region.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, thank you very, very much. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Phil. All the best, eh?
Thank you, John Philpott. By the way, that's a country of millions and millions of people, and they are a major player in that part of the world, and it was like it's like a tree fell in the forest here, right? So which is why you're listening to the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. And you can write to us, Taylor@CIUT.FM, and you can check us out, Taylor-Report.com.